happening? What's the buzz? Tell me what's happening. What's the buzz? Tell me what's happening. What's the buzz? Tell me what's happening.
Why should you want to know?
There's only one reason that you want to know stuff. Because you will be tested on it in a standardized exam. Happy Friday. I'm Bill Radke. You're about to get smart regarding this week's big news on The Week in Review. My guest this week, Essex Porter, Cairo 7 reporter. Hi, Essex.
Good morning. Glad to be here.
Welcome back. Joni Balter, Civic Cocktail on Seattle Channel. Hiya.
Good morning.
And Knut Berger, the Mossback at Crosscut.com. Hey, Knut.
Hey, Bill.
The Seattle backlash against standardized testing grows. This week, critics of the new Common Core test said that as many as half of the students at Garfield High School, Roosevelt Ingram, Nathan Hale have opted out. They're going to boycott these tests. On KUOW this week, you heard many, many criticisms of standardized testing. Too high stakes, too limited, too biased, too many, too long, too unfair to teachers. And according to Kirkland mother Tanya Dimsey, too much pressure on her daughter.
I could see she's distressed. I mean, she's upstairs practicing typing for homework, and she's crying because she can't get it.
Okay, she's stressed out and upset, but is it right to refuse to take the tests? This Kirkland mother, Meredith Rashi, says her daughter is not stressed out, and even if she were,
telling her you don't have to take the test, you know, would send the wrong message at this point. I think that even if it's not going to be easy, there's going to be a lot of things that aren't going to be easy. You know, I want her to take it just for that reason.
What do you think? What should we tell our children? They can't make you do this, or toughen up and do it?
I think 11th grade is really tough. I raised two children through that grade. It is really tough. But on the other hand, what are you going to do? You can't get out of the SAT except for a few colleges. The GRE, the GMAT, life is full of tests. Now, our history here in this state is that whatever test we have, anybody remember the WASL? Whatever test we have, there's something wrong with it because the tests aren't perfect either. And there will always be sort of this animosity toward that test. It's about that test. You know, we don't have a better way to figure out where students are, and the information is power. We get power from knowing who needs what, who needs to do what to go ahead further.
Did anyone disagree? Do we have a better way than standardized testing, high-stakes testing?
Well, we do, teaching. I mean, I just think part of the Common Core problem is trying to make education a uniform thing. And I think education should be going in the opposite direction. I think it should be more individualized. I think
Where did you go? Lakeside and Evergreen?
Well, I was going to say, yeah.
Snob.
Big believer in alternative education. I have two kids, both college graduates, who are homeschooled. You know, I'm all for opting out. I'm all for questioning the system, our system of education. Part of the problem with the testing system is that the rationales for it aren't so much learning. This is how school systems get money from the feds, and this is how teachers keep their jobs. In other words, kids are often taking these tests not because of the inherent value of the test, but because the tests are designed to create a more, I think, corporatized system. And I think at the high school level, kids who are opting out are probably going to learn more through the process of boycotting than they would by taking the tests.
Interesting. Yes, Essex.
Well, I think it would be easier to defend the testing if the infrastructure were truly ready for it. A lot of the complaint that I hear about the testing is because the new Smarter Balance tests are done on computers, it takes away those computers from use in the routine educational day. So you not only have the burden of a test that is different and more difficult, even its supporters say, but then you also have the difficulties at many schools of giving this test without taking away educational opportunities from other students.
So, Knut, did you have no problem? You said you homeschooled your kids?
They were homeschooled for part of their education, yeah.
Did you have no problems figuring out whether they knew what they should know or not?
Well, kids are really good often at figuring out what they need to know and learning it when they want to learn it. You know, so we sort of subscribe to the John Holt School of Education. And interestingly, they didn't take tests when they were in junior high and high school. But when they went on to college, they made different choices about whether to take tests. My son really wanted to do well at the SATs. He studied for it. He took an SAT test to help him get into college. My daughter found an alternative way into college. So you know, ultimately they took the tests when they needed to and didn't take the tests that they didn't think were going to further their goals.
You know, there might be too many and too frequent tests, but we do at some point have to know where the students are so they can get what they need to pass the SAT or the GRE or whatever is coming next in life.
Some of us cannot or won't homeschool. I mean, that's a high bar for some people.
Right. And also, some of this kind of flies in the face of some of the other efforts among students themselves to take a lot of advanced placement classes. Some of the students really want to be in a rigorous program and want to be tested so that they can keep on moving.
These tests are called the Smarter Balanced Assessments. By the way, don't mark it to me in the title of your test.
Good point.
Just call it government-mandated exam. Anyway.
Awful day at school. Just
yes.
Call it that.
Yes, now we're all on the same page. I took the practice test for seniors, a little bit of it, and the first question has you read an essay about sustainability. It describes the environmental impact of a cotton shirt, where the cotton is grown, the water it takes, the insecticides, the energy to ship it, the movement for more sustainable methods, the rise of eco-fashion, the difficulty of knowing what we mean by organic and fair trade, this thoughtful essay, and you have questions like, select the sentence that best supports the conclusion that clothing manufacturers are not operating in an environmentally sustainable way. Which sentence summarizes the central idea of the text? What's wrong with that? It didn't seem dumbed down to me. It didn't seem narrow and limiting. And there are essays as well in these tests.
My objection to it largely goes to this idea that everybody needs to learn the same stuff at the same time, at the same pace, in the same way. Why do you have a classroom of, you know, 30 kids segmented off for a particular purpose? So my objection is much more, you know, much more structural than that. I would say some of the smartest people I know love taking tests. Some of the smartest people I know were horrible at taking tests. I don't think it's a determinant factor. I think it's largely imposed as a bureaucratic control.
But we have, like, my kid writes essays and gets marks on cooperating and listening. I mean, that's misusing the test, right? We all know that the test doesn't sum up your whole being.
Right. But I think the time is better spent if there's more kind of one-on-one time with the teachers and they're using what quizzes and tests there are to inform individual connection.
Okay. Well, unless we change the rules, Washington students will have to pass the Smarter Balance test to graduate. And the Seattle school system says that if a student skips the test, they'll be given a score of 0, which could hurt the school's overall passage rate. And here's what I say when my second grader is stressed out about a test.
Can you miss a lot of questions and still be happy in life?
Yeah.
If you miss a lot of questions, how do I feel about you?
You still love me.
Anything you want to add?
I can eat.
Okay. So that's just one approach. I'm gonna give the final word to fourth grade teacher and amateur musician Andy Bishop of Mount Vernon, who reminds you it's just a test.
Your head starts pounding.
KUOW's Week in Review, right back. We are going to talk about the state budget, and we will quiz you.
Before the big test, get a good night's sleep. Be in charge of the test like a farmer with a sheep. Wear loose-fitting clothes that are super comfortable, feeling like a champ from your head to your toes.
KUOW's Week in Review with Canute Berger and Joni Balter. And from Cairo 7 News, Essex Porter, analyzing this week's big stories in the Pacific Northwest. The biggest story in the country has been this shooting in South Carolina. By the way, do you think Seattle police just got any closer to approving body cameras?
Seattle police were always, especially the leadership, always interested in body cameras. I don't know that they got any closer to approving it. Clearly, there's been plenty of public pressure already. This simply reinforces that. The problems with body cameras and all of the police cameras are legal, really, and logistical. When you start amassing huge amounts of video, how do you respond to those public disclosure requests under our public disclosure law in a timely way that also protects the privacy of people who are entitled to that privacy under the law? So, you know, how do you not redact too much? How do you not respond too slowly? those are the real issues in Seattle.
And, of course, this wasn't body camera. This is bystander cam. And there have been so many disturbing police videos. Do you think this one stands out to the point of making a change?
Well, I think it's the succession of them, if you think about it. And we've all watched these videos. It's amazing when you watch the evening news how much a bystander's cell phone video is driving what's being presented as the nightly news. This is such a big deal now. To the specifics of this, we all saw the Pasco, Washington video, which was similar to this, although we can debate that there's a little bit of a difference. But each of these is increasingly horrifying that this goes on. I did want to address for 1 second your thing about Seattle police. Essex is exactly right that the storage of this material is really kind of one of the big problems. But I will say that Seattle Police Department loves data, and they love the idea of transparency. And so eventually our police will be wearing body cameras. No maybe about that.
And the argument, frankly, yes.
You know, body cameras have their limitations. I've seen body camera video where the police officer's use of the weapon simply blocks the camera as he extends the arm. So it's bystander video that is just as important as body cam video. And, you know, people need to understand that under the court rulings, they do have a right to take those bystander pictures, even if police are objecting.
You two were debating a couple of bystander videos. Just to quickly catch us up this week, in South Carolina, police officer stops a man for a taillight check. The man, Walter Scott, runs away. Officer tasers him. And then as the man is running, unarmed and non-confrontational, running away, shoots at him 8 times, I think. Kills him, doesn't administer any medical aid that we can see, possibly plants evidence next to him. And Essex and Joni were debating whether this is or isn't like the Pasco, Washington video where the rock thrower was killed.
So I say it is like the Pasco, Washington video in this regard. What you have in both cases is you have someone who is unarmed. That's key. And then number two, running away from an officer. So not threatening that officer. And in the looks of both videos, not threatening the public either. They're mad about what happened a few minutes ago. But then you're shooting somebody who's running away from you, who's unarmed. Where's the danger? What's the justification? I don't get it.
And there's really not that sharp of a difference between me and Joni on this. It's just that in the Pasco video, the person who was ultimately shot is running away from police, then turns toward them, appears to be raising hands for a moment, drops hands. So there is more to look at and discuss as to whether there was any kind of threat. But I don't think there's a super sharp difference between
them. I think it goes to an issue that these things often get into a he said, he said kind of situation, with the benefit of the doubt going to the police officer, who often controls the event itself and the tenor of it, and their sense of threat, et cetera, defines whether or not a shooting is justifiable often. And the bar is so
low. And then
they
control the report afterwards.
Well, exactly. And so I think one of the significant things about this video is that the police officer filed a report that did not accurately reflect what was in the video. So you actually see a police officer not only shooting down somebody who is running away, and you arguably treating him rather callously afterwards in terms of not providing any assistance, but apparently planting evidence, then filing a report. And I think another significant thing is the fact that because of this, the police department itself acted by firing, and the guy has now been charged, the police officer has been now charged with murder. But I think it goes to something that underlies all these cases, which is who do you believe? And are the police always the good guys? We would like to believe that, but, you know, the video shows in some cases it's just not true, and you wonder how many other cases like this are there.
That South Carolina officer Michael Slager is being held without bond pending a hearing this summer on a murder charge that could put him in prison for 30 years to life. And I want to get back to Northwest news now. In Olympia, state lawmakers are trying to agree on a new budget. One obstacle is that Washington voters passed an initiative requiring smaller class sizes, and that costs money. Here's an idea. What if legislators sent that initiative back to us with a note that says, we would like to do less than what you told us to do? The state Senate has passed a measure to modify Initiative 1351 by shrinking classes not in every grade, but only in kindergarten through third grade. They would have to put that modification back on the ballot. A new statewide poll indicates voters are likely to say, no. Who's being more irresponsible here, lawmakers or voters?
Well, let me argue with you on what the meaning of that poll says just for a sec. So the poll says that if you put it back out on the ballot with no money on it or just general support for it is 53%. Then it says if you ask folks, you know, if it did have the money on it, it goes down to 48. Remember, this thing passed by a whisper. Absolutely, you know, 50, what was the number? 50.0 something or other. So that poll isn't precise enough to tell us what would really happen, other than I sort of buy the 48%. If you put the money on there, the support's going to drop from that very precarious 50% plus something down to a much lower number. And so, you know, look, lawmakers don't really have a choice. They're already raiding the marijuana fund in one budget to try to balance the budget. There isn't the money for this. The voters should have been presented, shoulda, coulda, woulda, with something that had money on it, because this thing is darn expensive.
So passing this was more irresponsible than shrinking
Remember the argument that those who supported it would give, which is our Constitution in this state says education is the paramount duty. So do education and figure out everything else after. And so they would say, you know, since education is a paramount duty, we don't have to pick a funding source.
The Constitution doesn't say you have to have smaller class sizes. It says it's more general, obviously.
Yeah, but the public has voted more than once saying that it wants smaller class sizes. This is not the first time the legislature has resisted implementing an initiative.
But every time they ask the question, they don't put the money with it.
But the legislature has the power to come up with the money if they chose to. They can either do it through reallocation of funds or they can raise taxes.
And plus, the smaller class sizes now become an obligation in the Supreme Court case where the legislature is acting under a contempt citation. Because remember, the Supreme Court said you legislators passed a plan years ago, which includes smaller class sizes, and you're not implementing it. That's why you're in contempt.
Yeah, I think the voter will on this is pretty clear. And I think the poll is somewhat encouraging in the sense that people are still saying, yeah, this is what we want, by roughly the same, a little more than the percentage that it passed. But they're also reflecting a reluctance to pay for it. That's where the rub is. And I think all the legislators in Olympia seem to have decided that this particular initiative, which they think, which they basically say is a teachers union initiative, is bad policy, and they've worked really hard this session to try and limit initiatives in general as a result of this initiative. In fact, there was a proposal earlier this session which would have made it you could not do an initiative unless it paid for it.
Yeah, what do you think of that?
No, I think that's a bad idea. I think it's up to the legislature to figure that out. And initiatives, in some cases, don't necessarily have a dollar figure with them. They are establishing a particular principle that the voters want.
Okay, so much there for so much fun. Look, these initiatives, they come, they go, they cost a lot of money, and then sometimes they reduce your ability to act as a legislature. You know, at some point we are going, if it continues, if this kind of spending without the money attached, lawmakers eventually or somebody is going to pass an initiative to reduce the initiatives. Because we can't afford some of them. Some of them come with a huge price tag like this. And so now we're having this debate. Should you have lower class sizes K through third? Does it mean the whole banana? What does it mean? So eventually this will settle itself out, I imagine.
Again, the state Senate wants to shrink this initiative that would shrink class sizes very, very quickly. Will the House go along, yes or no?
Well, the House passed the same thing without sending the initiative back to voters.
Is that a yes or a no? I'm not a smart man. You have to really dumb this down to me. You should see my standardized test scores.
You know, I don't know what the House would.
I don't think anybody at Olympia wants to implement it.
I think the House is willing to pay for K through 3 because that's where the data shows that it's most effective. But nobody has the money. It's not like, would they? Are they happy? Do they want to? Nobody has the dough to actually do this without doing something else very dramatic.
Washington legislature meets you in the privacy of your car in just a few minutes on KUOW, and we really heard from you on our Facebook page at KUOW Public Radio on this topic. That's coming up. We're live tweeting the show at KUOW. Join us there right back on the Week in Review. KUOW's Week in Review. I'm Bill Radke with Knute Berger, Essex Porter, and Joni Balter. Coming soon to a river mouth near you is a 700-foot cargo carrier any match for a line of bobbing kayakers with a grudge. Shell Oil has been towing a drilling rig across the Pacific toward Seattle to moor in South Elliott Bay until later this spring, when it's supposed to head to the Arctic Ocean off Alaska to drill for oil. Greenpeace activists have already boarded the rig in the North Pacific. Shell has asked a judge to kick them off. If the drilling rig gets to Elliott Bay, some Seattle activists vow to let it through and then trap it here by lining up a flotilla of kayaks that won't budge. Can kayaks stop the 50,000-ton carrier pulling this rig? And if the carrier can't stop in time, could the protesters' lives be in danger? How do you think this could turn out?
Well, so far, there's two words in this story that I absolutely love. Barnacled as a verb and kayaktivist.
Yeah.
I said it right. So those are two important words that we have going forward. I certainly do not want to envision what could happen if an oil drilling rig heads out, having been in Puget Sound, and a flotilla of kayakers are trying to stop it, because that sounds very dangerous. You know, look, this is a hot debate. Are we acting locally or regionally or nationally or internationally? This is just one of the most heated stories of the year, we'll say. And it cannot come down to a fast-moving large vessel against a flotilla of kayaktivists.
But it might.
And it might.
Well, these things are sometimes effective, sometimes not. It certainly reminds me of the old-growth tree sits, where protesters take up residence to try and change a policy. Of course, I mean, I think the best thing would happen would be if the city of Seattle found a way to keep Shell out. Then you wouldn't have to face this particular confrontation here. But
did you hear what Alaska lawmakers said about this?
Oh.
That if Washington state officials don't want to let this, you know, Shell base its Arctic drilling here because of the environmental concerns, then we ought to close the Boeing production plant if we're so worried about carbon dioxide emissions.
You know, and I would bring up, there are a lot of people who don't think it's the best thing to do to keep it out. There are a lot of living wage jobs that are at stake here. Terminal 5 of the port would normally be just closed and idle. But, you know, now there are people who work on the docks who will have jobs and living wage jobs working on this vessel. So, you know, it's by no means, you know, a unanimous idea that it'd be great if Seattle could find a way to keep it out. And because it is the port of Seattle and not the city of Seattle, you know, Seattle's options may be limited.
So we're juggling climate change and jobs happening all the time.
Well, if America were truly concerned about the oil coming out of the ground, you know, the federal government could simply say no Arctic drilling.
Which is the opposite of what they said. So.
Yeah, but I would argue it's true. You guys, I mean, we pointed out that we speak out of both sides of our mouths. I mean, we extracting resources from Alaska is part of why Seattle exists and has existed historically.
Yeah.
So none of us is living a completely consistent life in that way. But there are certain activities that are worse than others. Drilling in the Arctic, drilling in that area is, I think, a particularly bad idea, potentially harmful to the environment. The government itself has said oil spills are virtually inevitable. It's a highly sensitive area that affects other industries here, such as fishing, such as crabbing. I think one can fill up a tank with gasoline but not be completely hypocritical by saying drilling for oil in this particular area is particularly a bad idea.
This kayaktivist thing may have started as a joke. According to The Stranger, a few protesters threatened at public port commission meetings to use their kayaks. The New York Times picked up the idea of a flotilla of kayaks in Elliott Bay, and Port Commissioner Bill Bryant laughed it off.
We're going to move forward, and we're going to have Shell there. The first drilling rig will arrive in early April, and we've been threatened with a flotilla of kayaks to block it. So we'll see what happens.
Yes, we will see what happens. That audio came to us from the Stranger. A port spokesperson told the Stranger that port police have never dealt with a situation like this. The Coast Guard says at 11 knots, it would take that carrier more than a mile to come to an emergency stop.
Well, I'll just tell you, I'm currently reading Dead Wake about the Lusitania, and I just don't like to imagine all that on the high seas.
But it's not like something like this hasn't been dealt with before. You will recall in the late 80s, early 90s, the protests concerning some of the Navy ships that would come in for Fleet Week at Seafair. Boats would go out to try to form a line to block them, and the Coast Guard would deal with it, and nobody was hurt.
Again, that Shell drilling rig was supposed to pull into Seattle next week. Greenpeace activists have boarded the carrier. By the way, have you seen that video of these Greenpeace folks climbing aboard? We have audio from it anyway, and it's just they speed up to this thing in a motorboat, and they attach ropes to it, climb up at high speed, unfurl a banner. It looks like Captain Phillips without the bloodshed. And so if this rig makes it to Terminal 5, some local kayaktivists say they're going to blockade it. Should we? This is better video than it is radio. Maybe we could, Sarah, do you think we could post that video what our Twitter feed? And yeah, okay, at KUOW on our Twitter feed. So if this rig makes it here, it could be blockaded and maybe prevented from heading to Alaska to drill. We'll watch it all for sure. It is time for a little break on KUOW's Week in Review, and then we're going to talk. Do we really want to ban cell phones in cars, or do we just say we want to ban cell phones in cars? Stay tuned. From the Seattle Channel, Joni Balter hosts Civic Cocktail, contributes to Bloomberg View. From Crosscut.com, Knut Berger is the Mossback. He writes at Seattle Magazine, too. And at Cairo 7, reporter Essex Porter covers the news, and that's what we're doing right now, sharpening you up on the news of the week. I'm Bill Radke. Do we really want to ban all smartphone use while driving, or do we just say we want to? It is already illegal to talk or text on a handheld phone while you're driving. That's been outlawed for 8 years and roundly ignored, right? People talk on their cell phones.
Yes.
See it all the time. Well, this session in Olympia, there was a proposal in the legislature to go further, to ban all phone use while driving. No reading on your phone, not even GPS directions, not even while you're stopped, not even at a red light. It passed the Senate, but this week it died in the House. If it didn't pass this year, I suspect it will never pass. Who disagrees?
I think I do, because I think it's such a danger out there to have people just flagrantly driving down the freeway, which I have observed, and texting, and I don't know what else is on there. They're probably ordering stuff on Amazon for all I know, but just on the phone while driving the freeway. They are also weaving. They are also some percentage much higher to be causing accidents.
Weaving didn't start with the cell phone, right? We do lots of dangerous things. So what makes you think we're truly going to outlaw this?
Well, I think it takes a certain amount of political will, and it takes sort of a better understanding of how dangerous these activities are. Now, as soon as you get into these conversations, you say, okay, what about the woman with the eye makeup? What about the guy with the sandwich? Well, looking down at your phone and as if Facebooking is different from texting. You know, the attention loss.
Reading is different from texting.
Right.
It's much less dangerous.
Right, but the person who's sending a little note to their friend or tweeting, that is not any different as a distraction. And it's very troubling and very dangerous. And I think Skip has a story to tell.
Oh, well, yes. The topic could not have been set up better for me this morning, because at 45th and University Way, as I was crossing University Way, I almost got run over by a woman in an SUV who had pulled way into the crosswalk, was looking at her smartphone, and then started to make her right turn right in front of me. And I had to say something, and I had my hand on the hood of her car.
That's just bad cell phone use. We need to practice more and get better at that.
And And the fact is, I mean, with cell phones, and I've done it. I've talked on the cell phone in the car. I've looked at, I've looked to see who called me and that kind of stuff. I try to do it at lights. You notice more and more people are doing that because when the lights change, often the three cars in front of you, nobody's looking, you know, and so everybody sits there hesitating.
That's what the horn is for. We got to start honking, Seattle. I know you don't want to do it, but you got to honk. As soon as it turns green, beep.
The thing is, when you know, these laws try to be so specific about what distracted driving is, like, you know, you can't text, but you could be updating Facebook.
But the reason for that is that when the law was passed, texting was the issue, and people didn't have so many smartphones that enabled them to do all this other typing into a cell phone while driving, and hopefully at the light, but that isn't that much better. You can't take in the whole area of what's happening, if there's a pedestrian, a bike, or this or that.
I'd just like to say, if you look at modern car ads, the whole pitch is they've turned your car into a rumpus room. You know, there's TVs, there's Wi-Fi, there are things to entertain everybody, and you're like in this little enclosed environment. You can't even hear the air going by while you're driving. It's like we're in these little cocoons. It's no wonder people stop paying attention to what's going on outside.
And I think that was part of the reason why it's so difficult to pass this. One is for many people, the smartphone is a true lifeline, whether it's GPS or getting the phone call or being in touch in some way. And the other thing is your car has tons of distractions before you ever even bring the phone inside. A lot of cars have touch screens. A lot of cars are now hooked up to Wi-Fi. Even Apple has a whole suite of applications that cars are bragging about having. So it's difficult to say, oh, gosh, just this one electronic device is the root of the evil, when there are so many other electronic devices, not to mention your fast food and your makeup, that are distracting driving.
But I just want people to be sheepish about it. You know, instead of like this flagrant, I'm so awesome because I'm on my phone and I'm driving and I'm having a sandwich and putting my eye makeup.
People are using phones flagrantly?
Yeah.
Flamboyantly?
Yeah. I would rather they look a little sheepish and try to throw it down when the officer shows up.
On our Facebook page, Sandy and Betsy want me to go shopping. Sandy says, I just use Google Maps, set the address, turn on the navigation, then the lady tells me where to go and I don't have to hold or look at my phone. Well, I have an iPhone 4, Sandy. Lar-dee-dar to you. Betsy says, I have a holder for the phone, so it's not in my hands. I also use my phone for podcasts and such, but again, I'm never touching the phone while driving. Well, I don't have a holder, Betsy. Okay? I'm paying bills. I got a mortgage. I have to go shopping?
You can afford a holder.
What about if you're driving a 47 DeSoto?
We'll get you a holder. You know. It sounds like we need to invest in that.
Okay, so is it fair to say that everybody but Joni, and maybe even Joni, believes that the more we use cell phones, the more we depend on it, the worse our traffic gets, and we want to do something productive while we're in the car? Joni, we're not going backwards. This is going to get harder and harder to pass.
But we're going to get dumber, or are we going to get smarter over time?
Well, we're going to get autopilot.
We're going to get driverless cars.
Yes, exactly. Take us out of the equation.
There's your last words. Take us out, please. This proposal to ban all phone use while driving died in the legislature due to lack of interest. The sponsor says she'll reintroduce it next year, where it will get even fewer votes. Or else Joni's right. We'll see.
We'll see.
We'll let you know.
We'll just dot, dot, dot on that one.
Back in a moment on The Week in Review. You're with Joni Balter and Canute Berger and Essex Porter. I'm Bill Radke. I'm not a big Amazon guy. I know they make it easier to shop for stuff, but since I don't like shopping for stuff, I've been able to avoid them. But this week, I learned about the latest Amazon innovation, which is when you're running out of something, you can push a button on that thing and more of it shows up at your door. And they're getting sensors put into products so you don't even have to do that. When you're running low, a chip automatically orders more. That's not shopping. That's avoiding shopping. And that might actually suck me in, and maybe you too. So I called the author of a book called The Everything Store, a book about Amazon, and I asked Brad Stone, should we worry about a company being so good at getting us to spend?
It's a good question. Let's view it in the simplest way possible, which is, making it easy to shop for things is generally a good thing. I think most people would agree. What Amazon released were these little devices called dash buttons, and they are labeled with certain big brands like Tide or Gillette or Bounty. And the idea is you stick them on your home appliances, and when you need more laundry detergent or paper towels, you just press the button, and they're Wi-Fi connected, and it'll add the item to your Amazon account. Now, this is one of a long line of innovations that Amazon has brought to market that simply make it easier to shop, that remove more of the friction. You know, the idea that you don't have to kind of put it on your mental list, that it makes it easier, is generally a good thing.
Yeah, convenience is good. I'm just watching the company put, you know, tentacles into even me. For example, Amazon is getting into home services so that I could vet plumbers and deck installers, and I can schedule the appointment all at once. That is something I might actually use. And so putting all this progress together and this convenience, is Amazon crushing competition even more like it did to brick and mortar bookstores?
Well, I guess that's a different question. It's, you know, and there's plenty of reasons to critique Amazon, but I don't think we should penalize them for just being good or for thinking about ways to remove barriers to shopping. I mean, look, no one else has been thinking about this stuff, and there's plenty of ways to improve the supermarket shopping experience. So, you know, you got to give Amazon some credit for thinking about these creative ways to make shopping easier. I hate, like you do, Bill, going to a big box store, trying to park, going in, wrestling with the crowds. And you have to give Amazon some credit for the fact that they are reinventing from the ground up the shopping experience.
Okay, but could other companies come in and do the same things? Or is Amazon locking up markets and stifling competition?
I don't think there's evidence for stifling competition in most markets. I mean, clearly there's a case to be made in books, but that's a different topic. But could other companies come in and do this? Yes. And I would think that the dash button is in some ways almost a defensive move, because one day your washing machine, your refrigerator, your stove, all these things are going to have their own connections to the internet. Your refrigerator will know one day when you need more items, and it will help you order those items. And so at Amazon, they have to be thinking of where do we play in that future, and how can we help our customers make that an easier experience? So there's no evidence right now that anyone else is thinking as aggressively as Amazon is, but I'm sure if you're a Walmart, you know, the largest supermarket in the world, you're starting to look at some of these devices and starting to wonder, do we need to be playing in this market as well?
That's the author of The Everything Store, Brad Stone. I hadn't thought of that. Amazon on the defensive. We all know Amazon has been wonderful to us in Seattle. When we want more jobs, we don't even have to push a button. Amazon just delivers it to our economy automatically. But should we be concerned? Should I resist them? Do you resist them?
Well, I just can't take it terribly seriously. I mean, I suppose if you wanted to look at the big picture, you could say, well, this would be a threat to Costco because you can just punch your button a bunch of times and get a whole pallet of Bounty paper towels delivered to your door. The commercial that, or the
well, is that a threat to Costco? Or are you laughing
at? I'm saying
that
potentially,
off?
But what I'm laughing off is the sort of lifestyle this whole thing is based on. It's like, what, maybe they're employees, like obsessive compulsives who don't get out much and have a lot of money, so they're not price conscious. Mm. And somehow, you know, actually picking up their smartphone to place an order is too onerous. So they have to, I'm out of toilet paper. I better press this button.
Hey, I'm
right
driving now. And Joni Balter wants you to outlaw my use of the phone.
There you go. There's a practical function, you know.
I think that works.
Cars.
Yeah. So the most interesting thing that he said there I thought was fascinating was the idea that I could go out to coffee with a friend of mine and say, I'm not getting along with my refrigerator. My refrigerator went out and ordered all this stuff and just filled itself with things that I don't like to eat.
Like the Sorcerer's Apprentice. It just keeps filling itself.
It just keeps filling because, you know, it's connected, as he said, to the internet. And here comes all this food that I don't eat.
You know, as much as the manufacturers would like it, I don't really want to make a lifetime commitment to a particular detergent.
That's right.
Dash button is a problem for me. I don't want to, I have to hit whatever again. You know, even when I like something, I don't want to make a lifetime commitment. So there's very few dash buttons, if any, that I would have at my place.
Well, I noted that they have ones for Izzy sodas and Lara bars, you know. So if you have a Lara bar crisis, which people in Seattle could at any moment, you know, all you have to do is hit your Lara bar button and they're going to magically appear.
Possibly by drone, right?
Mm-hmm. That's right.
Okay, well, when possible, I like to give the last word to goats. When Amazon launched its home services, Its offerings included plumbing and TV wall mounting and goat grazing, which we actually use in the city of Seattle. Have you seen the goats munching the vegetation?
Oh, yeah. They're great.
Oh, yeah.
Pike Place Market and what, Capitol Hill, maybe? And if you roll your window down and listen closely, you can actually hear the sound of goat grazing.
And it sounds like locusts.
That's Tammy Dunnigan, head goat wrangler and owner of Rent-A-Ruminant, LLC. Repeating our top story, there's something called Rent-A-Ruminant, LLC. This is KUW's Week in Review. We'll be right back. Canute Bertzer, don't let me interrupt you.
Yeah.
What were you saying?
I was just still talking about the Amazon thing. It's a bunch of brands that you wouldn't buy anyway.
And then we're going to get a button to get those extra goats delivered once the other ones get tired and are not chewing enough.
You need another tin can, and you just press a button with your cloven hoof.
Well, I mean, what if you want the unscented Tide?
Right.
You know what I'm saying? I mean,
yes.
It's like our whole society is designed to have so many variations of every product that the old days of just going Kleenex.
We're going back to that.
There you go.
Yeah, I only have one button. With the Highway 99 tunnel project 2 years behind schedule, Metro Transit wants another $17 million to keep buses moving through the construction zone. A legislator from Southwest Washington says local bus service, that's not the state's problem. Seattle, King County, you pay for it. These cost overrun questions are going to come up again and again. So how do we know who pays what in this cost overrun world? What is our rule of thumb? Joni, what do you think?
Well, I'm going to go with it's a state project, and that mitigation, also known as extra buses in this case, was part of the plan. Now, I do think it gets a little closer when you say how much mitigation and how many years does it go on for. But you got to look at what this is.
Well, if it's an overrun of a state project, then it goes along buses for the duration of the overrun.
So that's where I end up on the side of state budget is benefiting from, you know, all the stuff that's going on in Seattle. So the anti-Seattle stuff gets a little old sometimes.
Okay.
Right?
State, you pay for it. How about you, Essex?
Well, I can imagine, I don't know for a fact, but I can imagine some of the lawmakers who don't live around Seattle just loving to tweak their Seattle colleagues and just knowing that this will get a headline in Seattle Times and Seattle colleagues will be all up in arms about it. But, you know, I think Joni is on the right track. When, you know, whatever the project is, whoever causes the damage or the trouble is supposed to mitigate it. In this case, it's the state project that is running long, so it's the state obligation.
Wait a minute. What about the stick it to Seattle language? The Highway 99 tunnel legislation says past a certain point, cost overruns will be borne by property owners in the Seattle area who benefit.
You know, both a Republican and a Democrat attorney general say that language is basically inoperative. It always makes for a good story and a great headline, but it always comes around to the fact that the language is inoperative.
And it's inoperative because it's meaningless. What does that mean?
That's right.
Seattle area property owners who benefit. Please all raise your hands if you benefit. And then you can begin paying, and we'll have a little button on your desk that you push so you pay for bus service.
So violating the intent of the legislation is going to win us friends everywhere. You know, this is the thing. I mean, they said after the fact, well, we put that in there because it was never going to be enforced. You know, I mean, I think that's just disingenuousness of that. It clearly was the intent of the legislature to have people of Seattle pay for overruns. The question is, are there going to be overruns and who's going to pay them once you get through all the legal and insurance companies and everything else? But what I think
Joni and Essex, you would overturn the health care law because it's so hard to figure out what they could have meant.
I just want to finish my point, which was there will be increased expenses as a result of the delay collaterally. We've already heard that there may be increased expenses on the waterfront redo. Because it's getting pushed out X number of years, prices may go up. It may be more expensive to do that. We already know that there may be some damage to infrastructure under Pioneer Square, such as sewer lines, which the state has mandated. That's not covered by the budget, so that would have to come out of another fund.
So at what point should Seattle pay?
Well,
For what?
I don't know because I don't think we know how all the legal stuff will work out. We don't know. It may be that insurance companies pay for all the cost overruns.
No, then it's free.
Yeah.
Well, let's go back to that intent point that you made. If it was intended for Seattle somebody to pay for this, they might have written it a little differently so it would have some legal heft to it, because it's written in a nonsensical fashion.
On purpose.
It was written to
get Eastern Washingtonian voters, non-Seattle area voters, to vote for it.
But not to have any meaning.
Without it being enforceable. And that's pretty sleazy. It is.
Yeah, okay.
Does anybody remember who wrote it?
It was Ed Murray, wasn't it?
I'm not sure. Oh, I don't think it was.
Stan Freberg?
Well, I think he promoted it.
Essex, last word on this?
First, you got to define overrun. You know, actually, the tunnel project only has the potential for overruns. It's still within its budget.
Ah, okay. So we're not even there yet. We're just laying the groundwork, so you'll know. You'll know the whole debate when it comes up and hits your windshield. Crews are still fixing the broken cutter head on Bertha. The latest inspection from the ground around the viaduct showed settling of another 1/8 to 1/4 inch. Some of the column cracks have gotten wider. Transportation officials say, worry not, the viaduct is still safe to drive on. And then there was the other big story this week, as we come to an end of the week in review. The Seattle Mariners started this week undefeated, finished the week last place in the American League West. Their new hitting star, Nelson Cruz, top home run hitter in the major leagues last year, is hitting .091 for the entire season. Okay? He's making $14 million this year. He only has one hit so far, so that's $14 million per hit.
I think the hype of the first week gets a little silly. Wait till the team gels. It's supposed to be great. Everybody thinks they're going to really be, you know, playoff material. You can't judge it by the first week.
You know, they didn't.
You did detect my sarcasm, right?
Oh, yeah, okay. No, I got some of it.
Thank
yeah,
just yeah. They didn't call Reggie Jackson Mr. April.
Ah, nice. He's biding his time.
Oh, I'm just in that mode where it's like, you know, talk to me at the All-Star break, then I'll have an opinion about the Mariners.
Well, remember last year they missed the playoffs by one game. So these do count. I'm just letting you do know they count, right?
They add up.
They add up.
All right. Okay. I kid because I love Mariners. We have 159 games to go. This is the Week in Review on KUOW 94.9 Seattle News and Information. Joni Balter, Seattle Channel host of Civic Cocktail, contributor to Bloomberg View. Knute Berger is the Mossback at CrossCut.com and a columnist with Seattle Magazine. Essex Porter reports at Cairo 7. Anybody want to tell us something that you're working on that we should go find out more about you?
I have to tell you, I'm working on vacation. I'll be away next week.
Oh, okay. Can I come?
No.
All right. Expected that. Joni, Civic Cocktail?
I'm working on a piece right now for In Close on Channel 9.
Oh, really? What's it about?
Seattle growing kind of quickly.
Kind of?
Just kind of.
This just in. Knute?
I've got a story coming out next week about the state of heritage funding at the state level, looking at how our museums, et cetera, are faring in the budget.
My daughter's going to be very interested in that. She says hi, by the way.
Hi back.
Tweet us at KUOW. Talk with us on Facebook, KUOW Public Radio. This show is produced by Jason Pagano. And go to our website, not while you're driving, but you can get our podcast, iTunes, Stitcher, all those kind of things. Thank you for listening, and let's talk again next week. I'm Bill Radke.